I'm Christopher Lydon, listening anew to the gunman Omar and the detective Kima Greggs from The Wire on HBO, the TV series that changed so much, including the people who made it. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the afterlife of a cable television show, about the underside of Baltimore and maybe 100 big American cities. Drugs, crime, work and want of work, language, human complexity of all things, good bad guys and bad good guys, the media business of what's news and what's never in the failing Baltimore Sun. This was a show that made a real stab at reality television and then quit while it was way ahead after 5 seasons. That was a year ago, but the story continues, as they say. The Wire will be taught as a Harvard course next year, and two of the key contributors who are part of teaching The Wire are also still dealing with what it stirred up in their own lives. Our conversation was with the real Donnie Andrews, a freelance killer of drug dealers in Baltimore, who fired up the idea of The Wire and inspired a major character, Omar, in it, and the actress Sonia Sohn, who played the often anguished narcotics cop, Kima Greggs. Donnie Andrews, the real Omar of Wire fame. How does this happen? How does it work?
Well, I think David, he's an ex-crime reporter from the Baltimore Sun.
David Simon.
David Simon. Ed Burns is a retired police officer for 20 years. And this, I guess the stories that David covered, the arrests that Ed made, you know, they kind of like filtered it all together, you know, and, you know, doing any type of investigation, you kind of like get entwined in what's going on, because you look at the criminal element and you see how brilliant these guys could be in a regular business world. And to see that their only expectation is to be ghetto famous, as I call it, you know. And David, him and Ed, after doing the corner, you know, which is, I'm married to Fran Boyd from the corner. And when he was right in the corner, he had called me. I was in federal prison. And I called him.
Had you ever met him in, shall we say, the professional line of duty? Cool. Had you ever met either David as a reporter or Ed Burns as a cop?
Yeah. Ed was my arresting officer.
Oh.
Ed was my arresting officer. David covered the story. So, it's a long story.
Give us the highlights.
It was during a time where I think I was at my lowest point. Because I just lost a very dear friend of mine who died in my arms, and a guy that I know most of all my life. And as he was dying, you know, he asked me who he was, who was I, and I told him, Donnie. And he said, Donnie, I can't see you. He said, I can't see you. And at that point, I realized that I couldn't see myself either, you know. And that was the turning point for me. But then I went on. It was like we had a war going on, a drug war, you know, with the terrorists and down Lexington terrorists. And, you know, we all was assigned to take somebody out. And the guy that I took out, I already put like 4 bullets in him, and I stood over top of him. And he looked up and asked me why, you know, and...
Was that his word?
Yeah, why, you know, and I stood there for what seemed like an eternity trying to figure out that question, you know, why am I doing this, you know? He's black just like me, got a mother, brother, sister, family just like me, and I just took everything from him, and I don't even know why. You know, and at that point, it began to turn my life around, And so I went home and I read the Bible, Paul, you know. And after I read Paul, because this happened like, you know, in the early morning hours, because it was like in Baltimore they have all night drug territories. And so I read the Bible for 2 days. I didn't come out the house for like 2 days, and I just kept reading Paul over and over and over. And finally I realized that if Paul, who did basically the same thing that I did, God forgave him and converted him, you know, so maybe he can do the same for me. So I got on my knees and I prayed. And about 3-4 months later, you know, Ed, he was doing an investigation along with the feds. You know, they had a, he was co-assigned to the feds, but he was doing homicide. And they woke me up like 3, 4 in the morning. You know, me and my girl, we landed naked. And they kicked my door in. And they was looking for guns or anything that could get me, you know, behind bars.
Were you ghetto famous by then?
Yeah.
For what?
How? For robbing people. Hmm. You know, and so once they couldn't find nothing, you know, Ed touched, he just looked at me and said, hey, he said, you look like a man that want to talk. You know, something is on your mind. Hmm. And I was like, I said, talk about what? You know, he said, whatever you want to need to talk about. You know, he said, because, he said, actually, you know, I feel like you're better than that. You know, you can actually get a second chance at life. You know, and at that point, I'm looking at him like, a second chance at life? The hell is you talking about? And, you know, but he left, but that thought stayed in my head. You know, I mean, even a fool would want to start over again. You understand? I'm like, if that could really happen, you know, I would be the most happiest man in the world. You know, I would say, I'd promise God. I said, God, I'll put down my guns. I would do everything. And it was amazing because after talking to Ed, I confessed to the murder. You know, they gave me 2 life sentences with the state and 1 with the feds, the 1 coterminous together. I was supposed to, you know, did the 10 years on just the 1 life from the feds and got released. But during that course, the prosecutor from the state reneged on me. When I finally did get in court in front of Judge Blake, you know, she looked at, you know, everything I did, because I went to school, got my GED, went to college where I was in prison until, you know, Congress decided that we was getting too smart and cut that out. And, you know, but she said 18 years, time served, you know. So being, you know, like I'm 55 years old, you know, and I decided at that point that if I got out of prison, I was going to do whatever I had to do to make a difference in my community. Mm.
Donnie Anders, I'm listening to your talk, and I feel I'm watching The Wire. Whose idea was it to say that a man's got to have a code?
Well, basically, I always did. If you're out doing something, then there got to be a mission. And for every mission, you need a code. You know, without it, you know, I mean, you got to be able to judge, you know, what's right and what's wrong, you know. And at that point in my life, it was like, you know, when I would rob people, I would go up, and the first thing I would do is say, y'all, give me a couple of them things, and I get back with you later. And usually they lie. Man, I ain't got nothing right now. Come back, you know, about 7:30, and I'll hook you up. And I say, no, you know what? Just come with me right now, and I'm going to take it all, you know. And that was my code, and I never, You know, the only person in this world to this day, you know, no, not to today, because right now I feel sorry for him. Only person that I ever feared in my life was my mother. You know, and that was basically because I couldn't retaliate. I couldn't, you know, react. I had to be the son. She was always mom's, no matter how my feelings was toward her. I could never disrespect her. And for that point, nobody would ever disrespect a woman around me, you know, because I look at it, that could be my mother, you know. And so I think that's where, like, the cold came from, you know. And we basically went from there.
Donnie, what is your answer to the why question?
That's the whole purpose, I think.
But you've had, what, 18 years to think about it?
And I'm still thinking about it. it's just one to just go on and on. And hopefully if we can push this program, you know, the way that me and Sonya want to push it, we can come up with that answer, at least a viable solution. You know, and basically it's right there in front of your eyes, you know.
Tell me about the program itself. What is the program?
Sonya can tell you about.
Well, Sonya, a.k.a. Detective Kima Griggs, what is the program?
Well, first of all, we'll start with the organization, Rewired for Change. This organization was started by myself and the principal cast and some of the crew of The Wire. Our mission is to help uplift and empower high-risk young people. We have developed an anti-violence self-esteem building program, and this program uses The Wire as a teaching tool. Essentially, what we do is we air the show, young people get a chance to look at an episode. We then discuss the character arcs, the issues and themes of the show with them. And by the end of the conversation, we turn that discussion around so that they're now discussing the show through the lens of their own lives. There's also a creative arts component to each module. And with the first module, it's poetry and spoken word.
How does that go? What does it sound like?
Essentially, what we do is we provide the young people with a composition book at the beginning of the program. We encourage them to use it as a journal. And we also ask them to create poetry. Now, a lot of times, they've never written poetry. Some of them have rapped before. And we introduce them to some of the rudimentary elements of poetry. You know, we introduce personification, metaphor, simile, try to show them exactly what those terms mean. And then we introduce them also to various types of poetry. We may introduce them to Langston Hughes. We may give them some lyrics from, you know, a T.I. song. You know, quite a few of them are not quite into the poetry thing at first, and we just encourage them to continue to write in their journals, and we let them know that they don't have to be afraid of poetry. Write in your journal. We can pull a poem out of your journal entries. At any rate, once these young people see that we're showing up to every class, and that once they see that if they miss two classes, we're going to call them. We're going to call their mother, their grandmother, their uncle, whoever it is they're living with, and to find out what happened to them. We may go by their homes and to check on them. And once they see that we're really committed, that's when the bond really starts to solidify. And at that point, we begin to move from poems about, you know, pimping and drug dealing and so forth to poems about being focused on what it is they want to do in life, and you know, they may actually use some of the terms that they're used to using. I believe the other day this one guy said that this one young man said that he was going to pursue a particular goal all the way to the casket, which means so now instead of sort of following his street dreams, he's actually, you know, saying, listen, I'm going to do this until I die. So
how did you get the Griggs character into your fingertips?
That's a really interesting question, actually. It was very difficult, and primarily because of my own history. I had been an actor for a while, studied. It had been years. I had already done some other, film work. And so I went about my normal way of preparing for a role. And my first year on The Wire was absolute torture. For some reason, and I did not know at the time, I would get on the set, and many times I couldn't remember my lines. I would go into a little bit of a panic, and it just it was something that I just couldn't figure out. And I thought, gosh, am I really this bad of an actor? And I thought, well, maybe it's because I didn't go the traditional route or what have you. But it didn't dawn on me. I didn't learn what was happening to me until a few years later. I will tell you. There's a scene in which Kima runs out and she beats Bodie down because he's hit a cop. And I was standing around a corner on my own and someone was giving me the cue to run. While I'm waiting for the cue, I look into the doorway of an apartment that looked very much like an apartment of one of my friends. It was unkempt. The children looked neglected, and there was a woman just sitting on a chair in a bit of a daze. And I went, wow, that looks like so and so's apartment from back when. And it was a flashback back to when I was about 10 years old. And then I heard rolling, and I went, okay. And I grabbed my gun and I go and I beat Bodie up. But I got to tell you something. That whole year, I was uncomfortable playing a cop. Later on that day, I have to shoot a scene in the police precinct. Must have been 6 hours later. And I just kept drawing a blank. I could barely get through my lines. I later realized that flashback was a part of complex post-traumatic stress syndrome. I later started learning about complex PTSD and realized that that a part of my brain was just shutting down. The entire year I was shooting The Wire, and I'll give you a more specific example, not just because I was having a flashback to someone in my neighborhood, to someone's home in my neighborhood. My mother was battered by my father on a somewhat regular basis. And in the neighborhood, you don't ever call the police, ever. You don't snitch, you don't call the police. But there were a number of times in which I thought my mother was going to be killed by my father. And I would run upstairs and just quietly, call the police and wait for them to come, hoping that, my mother was going to be alive when they came. And the police would come, and I thought, wow, good, thank God they're here. They're going to take them away. And they would talk a little bit, and they would leave my father there. And I'd go, why aren't they taking him away? And then over a course of time, like second, third, fourth time, they would come. And after a while, they just would sort of smirk and snicker, and just kind of poo-poo this thing away. And I started to hate the cops because I thought, you guys are supposed to help me. You're supposed to save my mother. And it's not happening. And as a matter of fact, you're now laughing at my family. So I realized that one of the reasons why I couldn't step into the character of a cop is because I had such deep resentment for the cops and a lot of pain, which was wrapped around just a lot of pain that eventually I had to unravel, which is why the Rewired for Life program was born for me out of that, knowing where I had come from and folks like Donnie and some of our cast members had come from, because we understand where these young people, how these young people are growing up right now. We understand the neglect, the abuse, the violence that they see on a daily basis.
There are characters in The Wire that sound like you. Do-gooders who are trying to confront these issues. And a lot of them are frustrated.
Well, when you and I, when you feel that you were born to do something, and you have lived through the kind of pain that I and Donnie have lived through, you have to only see the light at the end of the tunnel, because the only way we got through our the pain of our existence up until this point was because we could see the light at the end of the tunnel. If you start, you have to have blinders on. If you start looking at the darkness, if you start looking at the potholes, if you start, if you start paying attention to what's going to get in your way, then it's going to get in your way. So there's a certain kind of a belief or faith that comes with having taken that journey that that motivates you now to address sort of the hard realities, the harsh realities of this whole situation. I tell you, when I hear that, one of my students is, we call her our baby Snoop. She was in our first session. A week before she entered our class, a friend of hers was killed in a drive-by. And this was a quote-unquote good kid who was going somewhere, who was quiet and went to school every day. And this really took her aback. About a month after she had come into the class, there was a weekend in Baltimore in which there were 14 shootings. There was a shooting at a cookout in which 12 people were shot. She was at that cookout. 2 weeks ago, this past Saturday, she's walking down the street with her uncle. Her uncle's murdered in front of her face. So these are some of the stories that I have to we hear in our classrooms. There's a young man, Sean Hawkins, who's quote unquote our class leader. It was evident from early on that he was very bright and he could help lead the class and attend, and potentially be a youth facilitator at some point. He didn't show up to class one day, and he always shows up. The next week, we find out that on his way to class, he found out that his younger brother was murdered. He comes to class the following week, and we're in discussion, and at a certain point, he says, "Let me tell you, I don't know, if I see the dude who killed my brother on the street, I don't know what I'm going to do, so I can't tell you right now that I'm not going to, retaliate." The class curriculum for that day goes out the window, and we tell him, "Hold it. You don't make that decision when you roll up on this fellow. You make that decision right now when you can bounce your thoughts off of folks who are positive and who care for you. When you can sit here and do it in a relatively calm, peaceful environment where you can actually hear your thoughts." And so we spend that entire class discussing retaliation in general, but talking him out of retaliation. And he felt a tremendous amount of guilt for his brother's death, because his brother was following in his footsteps. His brother admired him. So this was quite a task.
In how many cities of this country do you think you could do a version of The Wire with the same cast of dealers and cops and kids?
Every city in America. Every city in America. Even right now it's hitting small counties. Actually, to be absolutely 100% truthful, The Wire is like eating a piece of candy compared to the real life out there, And so at what point do you stop running and take a stand, No, this ain't happening in our neighborhood, My kids play on this block. I want to be able to see them go out in the street, without me having to go to their funeral tomorrow. I want to be able to have my kids go out and play on the street with other kids, instead of trying to keep them and shield them in the house because I'm scared a stray bullet might hit them, The bottom line is, when we did season four, me, Ed Burns, and Bill Zorzi, we went to all the schools, because we wanted to get the real feel, of the kids today. And during one course, we went into an elementary school, and it was a group of little boys sitting at the table You know, so I went over. They said, "Hey," they called me over. I said, "Hey, what's up? You from the Y?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Man, we love that show." Ooh, and I'm like, "Okay, can you get us on there? Can you get?" I'm like, "Okay, but tell me what you want to be when you grow up." And the first little boy said, "I want to get shot." The second one said, "I want to shoot somebody." And the third one said, "I want to go to prison." Now, that's their expectation in life. We got to change that. We got to break that cycle.
Donnie, what do you hear from people you grew up with? People in the criminal life with you then? Where are they now? And what do they say about the new Donnie?
Dead, in prison. Most of them is dead. You know, most of them is dead. When I came home, you know, I could stand at the top of Emerson Avenue and look basically all the way to the harbor, because that's how much they had destroyed. The buildings that they didn't board up, they tore them down. Mm. And they just left empty lots. And the people that was around when I was around, most of them did.
What does it mean in the end that the Wire has gone to Harvard?
Well, gosh, you know, it means a lot of things. I think on a personal level, it was actually pretty mind-blowing. The first time I spoke in Professor Ogletree's law class, I addressed a group of young people, very diverse group of young people. Many of them, you know, were African-American. And it really, and honestly, looking out, you know, there, here I go again with my flashbacks. I remember being, you know, 7 years old, and at the time, you know, my father and I were close, and he said, you know, you could be a lawyer one day, you could be, you know, a congresswoman one day, and I thought, yeah, that might be right, you know, but you know, we didn't know that, you know, that there were going to be so many twists and turns in my life, but when I looked at that law class, I just went, wow. Because when I was in elementary school, I would be in a group. There would be groups of people studying. I studied by myself. And then when I moved up into, we were sent to school 20 miles away from our homes. I was in a group, and I was the only black person amongst all whites, which was incredibly intimidating for me. Mm-hmm. And I shrunk and shut down a little bit. So when I come to Harvard and I see all these African American law students, it's pretty mind blowing. It shows that, you know, we have come far in some ways. And then again, like to have Reverend Rivers, Professor Ogletree, Professor Wilson supporting. Actually, and analyzing the show and supporting the work that we do, it seems as though we got here. We just didn't get here the traditional way.
Sonia Sohn, Donnie Andrews, thank you so much for The Wire and then for this conversation, really.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with Donnie Andrews, the real Omar, and Sonia Sohn, who played the Baltimore policewoman Kima Greggs. Did The Wire show you something new about Baltimore, about your own urban America, maybe about yourself? Leave a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.